So this is all great advice, and it was, you know, the core theme is here, how you can more effectively communicate with the media to promote public health. So we kind of took an other approach. We became the media. So I'm an assistant professor at Drexel University School of Public Health. I'm a researcher, identify as a public health researcher, as is my colleague Mike Udell, who's also a professor at Drexel, and our colleague Janet Golden, who's at Rutgers. But what we did was we started a blog and a column called The Public's Health with the Philadelphia Inquirer, where we were and we are the writers. So a different approach. So what I want to do is kind of share that experience with you, and hopefully you can go to your local news media outlets and do the same. So just a little bit of history. This started back in summer of 2011. In short, our dean had lunch with the public health reporter and pitched this idea to have us write a blog for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She was a smart lady. I think she did it because she knew the Inquirer, like all papers, and like we've heard, super strapped for resources, layoffs like crazy, and they have to produce content, especially with web-based media. They have to get, you know, stories out there and sell ads. So she approached them with this idea. She didn't think that she could get any faculty to do it, so she volunteered me. I was a doctoral student at the school at the time. And I said, all right, this sounds like a cool thing to do. Maybe they'll pay me. They didn't really pay me, but it still sounded good. So they wanted me to write 3 times a week, and I said, that's absolutely impossible. There's no way that's going to happen. So they said, all right, well, let's get a faculty member. How about you guys do it together? So I reached out to Michael. Michael's a historian by training. He writes books for the popular press. Perfect guy to do this. So, we met with the Inquirer, Don Sapak and Carl Stark, who are our editors there, awesome people, and we set this thing up. So, generally, we post about, in the past, when we were at our heyday, about 3 times a week, which I think is really, really kind of the money number for online media. Anything less than that, they said, wasn't really a blog. And most of our pieces appeared in print in some form. They didn't tell us when they appear in print, but they often would when they needed to fill space. And we hyperlink as references. So we're academics. Whenever you would cite something in a paper, we hyperlink to that study, which kind of makes us feel comfortable, and I think that our readers like that as well, so people can kind of follow, go down the rabbit holes. And again, when we were at our peak, we had about 20,000 visits a month. Sometimes it was 30. I don't know if that's good. I think it's good. It's way less now because we've been posting less, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So these is kind of after the fact, after we were doing this, we're like, what are we doing here? What are the aims? And I think our primary aim was really to disseminate public health research in a format that's easy to understand. So as, you know, as academics, we really value research, and a lot of what we were doing was kind of research translation and putting out research for the public. We wanted to engage, and we want to engage the public in a dialogue about public health issues. We wanted to start conversations and change conversations about health, in Philadelphia primarily, but also beyond. And then lastly, along the same lines, we wanted to inspire science-based advocacy. We wanted to get people charged up about the things we were charged up about, and, you know, go to city council meetings and, you know, demand soda tax legislation, stuff like that. And because we were a blog, we were allowed to be probably a little more advocacy-oriented than a reporter ever could be. We still had some posts we'd write, and our editor would come back and be like, this is pure advocacy. You can't do this. You have to be more neutral. You have to, you know, give a nod to the other side. And then we go back and we do that. But I think we could be a little more advocacy-based because, you know, we are not really affiliated with the Inquirer. We're affiliated with Drexel, and we're writing on this platform. So why do we do this? So this has been a ton of work, and this is why, in part, we've done it less. But it's cool to engage in science-based advocacy, to say it in a fancy way, but really, to say it more plainly, you know, to kind of say what you want for a whole bunch of people and things that you're excited and things you're passionate about, to, you know, have this platform that people read and you know, advocate for stuff you care about. That's really cool and really a lot of fun. And also to kind of, you know, tell a different story, right? So about obesity and HIV and these issues, there seems to be kind of, you know, these standard stories. But this allowed us to kind of, you know, go outside that box and cast something, a health issue, in a new light. And also, which has been really valuable, is it's a great card to develop relationships across disciplines, institutions, and sectors. So I developed a personal relationship with the health commissioner as a doctoral student, all because of this blog. So if I emailed him as a doctoral student and say, hey, you're the health commissioner, I'd love to have coffee with you, it probably wouldn't happen. They say, hey, I'm writing this story about this initiative you're working on. I'd love a quote from you. Can we get coffee and talk about this? He says, yeah, sure. So this has opened a ton of doors for me. So that's kind of, you know, what's in it for you besides the benefits. I do believe there are benefits to public health for doing this sort of thing. And for the newspaper, you know, it's really free and cheap labor. They call it expert opinion, which is flattering, but that's kind of the bucket they put it in. But I think it's definitely a mutually beneficial partnership. So I've written about, I guess, 120 posts or so, and kind of going back and seeing, like, what are the themes here? What are the ingredients for a good post? And for any qualitative researchers, these are, like, inductively generated categories, right? So go back, look through everything, and see, like, what are the themes here? What do I think is successful? So one is a personal anecdote, and I'm curious what the reporters think of this as well, because I've never went to journalism school or have spoken to many journalists. But we often try to make the story personal in some way. Even, you know, I was talking to my wife about X, and then it goes off completely away from personal. But some personal hook, especially early on. Local, so not all of our stories were just about Philadelphia, but there are often local public health statistics, and you can bring in and cast the problem in a local light and localize the issue. Tying things to current events or popular culture, like the Olympics, for example, tomorrow's Election Day in Philadelphia, so we can do a story about voting and health, stuff like that. Historical context, I think we have just been told people like history. They find it interesting to kind of learn, you know, how did this become the way it is today? What are the historical antecedents of this? And lots of links. I think the more links, the better. Again, as I said, it's kind of how we reference, but we found that people clicked them, right? So we have data on that. People clicked the link. So that's presumably a good thing. And children and animals. Whenever we write anything about children or animals, it gets like 7 times more views than if we didn't talk about children or animals. It gets people really fired up. So again, my inductively generated categories. So I think there's like a typology of the type of posts that we have written. So I just kind of want to run through these real quick. So one is like the health education post. And I think this is most similar to your typical health section story. Kind of educating the public about health or maybe a health behavior. Kind of maybe you should do this because it's healthy. That sort of thing. So things about sleep. We've written about sleep. Written about stress and the practice of what's called written emotional disclosure. So there's this rich body of research about the benefits of writing down what you're stressed about and how you're feeling. So I wrote a story about that. And just kind of like, hey, this issue. This is something you can do to address this issue at the individual level to kind of keep yourself healthy. So the data wonk post, sometimes we just get really into a data set and use statistics to tell a story. So one thing I want to say here about how long can your baby expect to live. So we don't really get to decide the titles. We present it with a title for the post, but often that gets morphed and twisted before it goes live, and we don't always get to approve that. So I would not go with the post, how long can your baby expect to live. This kind of rubs me the wrong way. But this is what it ended up with. So this is a post just really about the metric of life expectancy at birth. Kind of, this is this metric. Here's the history of it. Here's what it tells you. Here's what it looks like in Philadelphia. Here are disparities within it. The expanded conversation post. So this is when we kind of take a known health issue and write about it in a new light. So, for example, how abandoned buildings can make you sick. So there were a number of structure fires in Philadelphia and old abandoned warehouses. There was a lot of discourse about how these buildings are dangerous, how there's toxic chemicals, how they're fire hazards, all totally true, right? But then there's kind of the psychosocial side of abandoned buildings and blight and broken windows theory and all that. So we kind of took that opportunity to cast this issue in a new light. So childhood sexual abuse, there was this Penn State scandal a few years ago. We used that as an opportunity to talk about the adverse childhood experience, a study, and kind of the long-term health effects of childhood abuse. The academic translation post, so here we just really focus on a study that was recently published and really just focus on that and talk about the rationale for the study, talk about the methods, kind of talking people through, this is what a prospective cohort study is, and this is why it's the best design, and talking about how you follow people over time, and really just going deep on one specific article that was recently published. So when we started this, I signed up for the table of contents alerts for about 50 different journals, and that was kind of a source, so you know, just skim through these things and see, all right, what did, you know, Health Education and Behavior just publish? And sometimes it's just really interesting stuff, and say, okay, I can access this article and I can write a post pretty quickly just based on that one study. And then the personal posts, really just kind of, it's much more self-reflection and me as a writer, or Michael as a writer, is really central to that. So I wrote a post about implicit racial bias. There are online implicit racial bias tests. I took one and kind of used my results to talk about implicit racial bias. I talked about how I used Thomas Friedman's health impact pyramid to explain to my mother-in-law what public health was at Thanksgiving dinner, because it's really hard to explain what public health is. So literally, I used this pyramid. I'm like, oh, that was kind of cool what I did. Let's write about that. And then lastly, the most successful posts probably aren't that important to public health. Dog poo. Dog poo got the front page story on a Sunday. Talking about the public health hazards of dog poo, where kids play. Very basic, very old school public health. Weed. These are the things that people really like to read about, and we get the most comments on and get the most hits. So challenges. The challenges have been many. So individual agency versus social structure. So we're trying to expand the conversation about health and talk about the social determinants of health. It's hard to do that and, you know, let people know that, you know, people aren't just products of, they're not stuck in their circumstances. Like, they have free will. You know, just because somebody's in a low-income neighborhood doesn't mean they're going to get diabetes for sure. You know, kind of that has been a challenge to talk about risk factors, but also the fact that people still have free will and people can be healthy. You know, it's not all doom and gloom. So time, tenure, and promotion reviews. So I'm on a tenure track. This doesn't really count towards much at all. I need to get grants and publish papers or I get fired. And our dean is very, very supportive of this. She thinks it's great, but it's not the currency in the academic world yet. People think it's cool. It probably counts for something. It's really enjoyable. It opens doors. But it's not what we really get evaluated on. So that's kind of a disincentive for us to do that. Evaluation, we don't know what the impacts of this are. We have data on page views, but so what? You know, I think maybe we care about more of this than other people because we are kind of research-oriented, but we don't really know what this is doing. There are a few academic peers that are a little more old-fashioned, just a few. Most people are very, very supportive of this, but think that, you know, researchers shouldn't be doing any sort of advocacy and shouldn't be writing in the public realm. That's for reporters, and that should stay separate. We very much disagree with that. And again, that's only a few people, but we have heard that. And also finding the blogging voice. It took a while to kind of find that way of writing for me and also for Michael. And also we recruit people all the time, but often what we get, it's not suitable for the blog. It's super academic and esoteric, and nobody's going to want to read this. So it takes time to find that voice, especially if you're used to writing, you know, grants and publications. It's a different style of writing, and it's kind of something you have to cultivate. Future aspirations, I'll just run through this so we can talk. We'd love to have it funded so we could do it more. Replication, so this is the fourth year in a row at APHA we've given this talk. I'm proud to say there have been at least two replications of the blog. I don't know what they're doing now, but one in North Carolina, one in Oklahoma, where people went to one of these sessions and then developed, public health people went to one of these sessions and developed a relationship with their local paper to do this. Daily posts, this is tied to funding and all the other challenges, but it would be great if we could have something up every day that just makes it stronger. We'd love to do some sort of evaluation, and we'd love for you to write for us. So really, I'm very serious. This is an open call. We're always looking for contributors. The benefits I outlined. It's fun. I will say it's fun. It's a lot of work, but it's also fun. And please let me know if you'd like to do that. I'm can hang out for a little bit afterwards, and I have to jet to another session. But here's my email address, so if you're interested and you don't get to speak with me, please email me. But if you are going to write for us, you will develop thick skin because the comments are horrible. You'll be called every name. People will email you. It's, you kind of get used to it, or you kind of don't, and it still hurts your feelings. But thank you.
So, cute animals. That's how we get public health in the media. A couple of questions from here before we get to the audience questions. Actually, one is from the audience. So thank you, at Amy Heaven. What does a good media pitch look like? And this, by the way, these questions are for all four of you, whoever wants to weigh in. So what does a good media pitch look like?
Specific. Sort of took, I think you made a great point that often people pitch topics, not stories. So,
Know the difference.
Yeah, know the difference. A story is a specific person doing a specific thing for a specific reason. So the more specific you can be, the better.
I would say also timeliness. We mentioned, you know, that I'm looking for a veteran story. If you're paying attention to the calendar and not the day or two before, we have, you know, to send a photographer out and stuff like that. So thinking ahead. Don't do the holiday blues. I'm so sick of that story. I've done that in at least four or five different incarnations. And I also think that Shannon's point about developing yourself as a source, even if you're not sure what the story is. Boy, I know who my go-to hospital people are in town. They tend to be the academic institutions like Rush, University of Chicago, Northwestern. But they'll say, gosh, you know, We just have some data on, let's mention HIV/AIDS. And we're seeing a big spike on the near north side, not the traditional, say, south side. We know that, you know, African-American gay men have been a vulnerable audience for a long time. But this is, say, white teenage girls or something like that. That it's like there's like great stories and data. I always thought that, you know, Census Bureau people do a good job if they see something. So we don't crunch the numbers.